Hi, everyone. It's Brian Kilmeade here. Are you tired of those uncomfortable dress shirts, especially when they bunch up under a sweater? If so, then you must check out Collars & Co., makers of the Dress Collar Polo. Listen up. These shirts are four-way stretch, buttery soft polos with firm dress collars on them, so they give you the dress shirt look, but extremely comfortable polo feel. You can wear them with anything, under a sweater, with a blazer, or by themselves as an elevated polo. They work for any occasion. These polos are perfect, whether it's in the office, on a golf course or a night out. Collars & Co. is exploding and have gone viral on social media thanks to the $1 million investment they received on Shark Tank from Mark Cuban and Peter Jones. You don't have to worry about collars that flop down and spread out. They stay firm and sharp all day. It's an amazing array of sweaters, quarter zips, pants, and outerwear. If you're looking for the performance dress shirt or polo that looks great all day, check out collarsandco.com. Use promo code Brian for 15% off of any purchase of $100 or more. That's promo code Brian.
From high atop Fox News headquarters in New York City, always seeking solutions, never sowing division. It's Brian Kilmeade.
Hi, everyone. I'm Brian Kilmeade. Thanks so much for listening. We got a big hour coming your way. Standing by, Oklahoma Senator James Lankford and Lieutenant Colonel Alan West. We're following a lot of stories, including one that's breaking, that we could have somewhat of a framework done to end the DHS partial shutdown. And we're also all over other news, especially the developing stories out of Iran. Let's get to the big three.
Number three.
It's just another one, another one. If they would simply just work with ICE, if their law enforcement would work with ICE when they arrest illegal aliens for crimes, we could save countless lives in this country.
That is Tom Homan. Two more illegal immigrants, criminal, with criminal records, kill Americans, and the state of Virginia and Illinois are ultimately to blame. Why the president has to drive this message home. It's how he got elected, and he can grab the momentum back on immigration.
Number two.
What we can do is pass the rest. We can pay the TSA workers and the rest of the Department of Homeland Security, and then do what we did this last summer, which is pass another reconciliation bill that will not only fund ICE, but do so without handcuffing them and limiting their ability to enforce our immigration laws.
Senator John Cornyn, you know he's going to run to keep that seat, but this is the breaking news. It looks like a framework's been hashed out with the president, two high-ranking senators, and the new secretary, high-ranking official, to frame out, along with Chuck Schumer, to frame out an agreement that would fully fund the DHS except for ICE. ICE would get its funding through a reconciliation package that's going to be coming up. I'll have to James Lankford on that because there's a lot to do with the Save America Act, which is not dead.
Number one.
We're giving it 5 days and then we're going to see where that takes us. And I would say at the end of this period, I think it could very well end up being a very good deal for everybody.
That is President of the United States. I'm not convinced. Iran and the U.S. in talks. I don't think they're going anywhere because that death cult of a government has nowhere to go. Use the Marines, Mr. President, to reopen the strait, finish off these thugs for the good of the world. Senator James Lankford joins us now. Senator, first off, I guess you know what John Cornyn has said and what we've learned, that it looks like you guys have made some serious progress.
We have. Good morning to you and everybody else. We have made some serious progress. Last summer, when we passed the One Big Beautiful Bill, we loaded extra funding into it for ICE because we knew at that time Democrats would never fund ICE. As soon as we started actually enforcing it, they would pull out. So we literally got ahead of them on it, doubled up the funding for ICE, did that with the reconciliation because we knew this day would come. This day is already here. So ICE is already fully funded. We have already fully funded ICE, so we could do another reconciliation to add even more to it, but it's fully funded right now. What is not funded is TSA, FEMA, our weapons of mass destruction, Secret Service offices, Coast Guard, all those things. So whatever bill we can pass right now to be able to get it done, we already thought ahead what the Democrats would do, and sure enough, they did. And so now it's time to be able to get it open. By the way, this is not just a conversation about ICE. It's a very small portion of ICE. The vast majority of ICE under even this agreement would be funded. Homeland Security investigators, all those folks would be funded already. It would be a very small portion that the Democrats are just caving in on, that they don't want to be able to do anything on it. So we've already pre-funded that.
So, Senator, what's important, too, is, okay, you can get a reconciliation bill going and fill up the 6% that's not funded. And you could do that and get the Save America Act involved, which needs some limited funding. So that'll keep it alive. You get that 51 votes, right?
That's right. That's right. In the Save America Act, we've been on it for days and days and days on the floor. I was back on the floor yesterday debating this again. It is so common sense just to require voter ID. For instance, 36 states already do that to require citizenship. States like Arizona and New Hampshire already do this as well. When you register to vote, you got to show citizenship. This is not a crazy idea. This is a normal common sense idea. But trying to be able to find a way to be able to get Democrats to be able to do that is going to continue to be difficult. So we can work some ways to be able to fund it through reconciliation. Let's do it and be able to work through the process.
But the other thing, that if you're not going to fund ICE, then there's no reason for you to change anything about ICE. So you'll decide. No. So ICE is not going to get any reforms that Democrats insisted on.
Yeah, the Democrats are demanding all these changes in ICE, and we said absolutely not. They're trying to make the entire country a sanctuary country rather than just have sanctuary cities. They want to be able to hamstring ICE. There's two things they want to do. They want to make it so hard on ICE agents and their families by protesting, screaming at them, trying to cut off their funding, that they will quit. And if they can't do that, to be able to make changes in the structure of how they operate, so they really are the ones handcuffed and they can't actually do anything. We're not going to allow either one of those. They need to be able to do their job.
All right. So that is Senator James Lankford, the framework. We could have a vote as early as Thursday.
Could have a vote as early as Thursday. There's still a long way to go on this. Democrats are making a whole new list of demands on it, and we're saying, no, you're not going to have your cake eaten too. We're going to actually work our way through this process. That's why we pre-funded this, because we knew this day would come, and this day is definitely here.
All right. Have ICE agents helped reduce the length of the lines at airports, do you know?
I don't know yet on that, Brian. What they're really doing is they're trying to be able to do some of the tasks on the outside so that the actual screeners and the folks that have to be trained to be able to do that can actually do their task. If only half, or in some of the airports, only half the agents are actually showing up as TSA agents, and by the way, I understand, they're now crossing almost 90 days this fiscal year where they're not getting paid between the first shutdown and this one. Not very many families could say, okay, I got 3 months where I wasn't paid in a year. That's really, really awful, and we're trying to be able to get that fixed on it. What Democrats have done to them is terrible. But so for those ICE agents not showing up right now, we're trying to be able to get the ICE agents that are normally on the outside inside in the screening process and free up the outside with some of the other ICE.
So DHS now has a new Homeland Security Secretary, right?
They do. They do. As of about 1:30 today, he'll actually be sworn in. But voted in last night, Mark Wayne Mullen, my colleague from Oklahoma, he's going to do a great job on this. He's very passionate about the security of the country. He also talks to everybody. He listens. He has no issue when working with local law enforcement. He's going to be a guy that's going to engage. He gets along great with Tom Holman, the border czar. He gets along great, obviously, long-term friendship with the president. So there's a lot of trust there from the president to Mark Wayne. But he'll do a very good job there.
I think so, too. And I think that that'll be an opportunity to get on a new foot with ICE. But there's something else going on I think is important. There was a woman, 18-year-old, killed in Chicago, and there was another one killed in Virginia. These are illegal immigrant criminals who were not picked up in these sanctuary cities now run by Governor Spanberger. And these people have had it. And this is part of the reason that Donald Trump was elected. Common sense laws. And Governor Pritzker says this is just a tragedy. Don't make it political. But he's the one who walked on that very block and said, there's no problem here. And an 18-year-old gets shot dead by a 25-year-old Jose Medina, and he gets charged with 6 felony counts. He missed his day's appearance. He's already been picked up for shoplifting, and then he becomes a murderer.
Yeah, and that's the painful part about this. This is why the Laken Riley Act was so important, because when we passed the Laken Riley Act early last year, it was if people come into this country illegally and they commit a crime, they need to be removed immediately, because Democrats would not do that at all. They continue to be able to shelter these criminal aliens in sanctuary cities. The people that live in those cities live under the oppression of that, to say that you are literally ignoring people in our community that have committed multiple crimes, and you want to say that you want those folks to be able to live here. There's a big difference between a legal immigrant coming into the country that our country celebrates and someone who is an illegal immigrant who's committing additional crimes even after they get here. Our country should not celebrate illegal activity. We should want a safe and secure country.
So the family of Stephanie Minter is going to show up at Governor Spanberger's house, and they're going to blame her for the sanctuary policies that allowed this killer, Abdul Jalal, who entered the U.S. illegally in 2012 and has multiple arrests from malicious wounding to three times pet trespassing, two times disorderly conduct, five larceny theft offenses, and is allowed to live in Virginia and then eventually kill their daughter. So they're going to show up. This is just insane.
It is insane, and it is the big reason, as you mentioned before, that President Trump won, because he just said it out loud. This should not be so. This is basic common sense. If someone is a criminal, they have broken into our country, they should be removed from our country, and Americans nod their head and go, yeah, that's right. Finally, somebody said it, and finally, somebody's actually doing it.
Senator James Lankford, let's talk Iran. Here's the president yesterday in Memphis. Cut two.
We're giving it 5 days, and then we're going to see where that takes us. And I would say at the end of this period, I think it could very well end up being a very good deal for everybody. As good as if we went all the way and just literally annihilated the place, which if we don't have to do that, that would be a good thing, not a bad thing.
So it looks like Pakistan, Turkey, Egypt using their emissaries to try to bring both sides to the table. And it looks like the Speaker of Parliament, who says some horrific things, and denies it's him, but it looks like it's him that we're dealing with. I just have very little faith that this is going to culminate in anything. What do you feel? How do you feel?
Yeah, the Iranian leadership cannot be trusted. This is the ultimate trust and verify. You cannot trust what they say, because they just lie over and over and over again. This is a terrorist regime that they want the total annihilation of every Jew on the planet. They don't like our freedom. They want the annihilation of the United States because they hate our freedom. They also want to be able to annihilate all their Muslim neighbors that live around them because of just their arrogance on their faith, that they believe that everyone else is apostate. And so that's why they have no issue with attacking Saudi Arabia and UAE and Jordan and so many other places, that they just say, well, their faith is not right, and so we're going to attack them. So you're right. You don't ever trust them in this. But we also have them in a difficult place where they can't even function. They can't operate as an economy. They can't walk out of their own front door. There does come a point where they want to be able to negotiate. The hard part on the backside of that is, how do you actually verify it and make sure it's actually so? They cannot continue to attack us with terrorism. They cannot continue to be able to shut down the Strait of Hormuz. They cannot have a nuclear weapon. Those things have all got to be verifiable.
Right. You have to find a way with those Marines, perhaps, to reopen the Strait. And they bat with showing that intermediate range missile that goes 2,500 miles. That puts the capital of Europe, the capital of Berlin, that puts London, and that puts Paris all in Iran's crosshairs if they choose.
Yeah, it is. And actually, it's why Europe continues to be able to say, hey, we don't want any part of this, because they live in fear of Iran. And they say, well, the only places that Iran is attacked is where their American base is. And so we just don't want to associate with any of this, so they won't attack us. That's the kind of pacifism that led to the Second World War, that actually led to the destruction of Europe on this. When there is someone that's actually trying to kill you and they're actively working to do that, you should take them seriously and say, you've got to make them stop. For 47 years, Iran has been attacking Americans in the area, attacking our Marines, attacking our embassies, attacking Americans that actually work and live in the area. This is the moment where President Trump is saying it's going to stop, and it's going to stop right now.
So just real quick, the next senator from Oklahoma to fill Senator Mullen's seat would be?
Alan Armstrong. Yeah, he'll be sworn in today about 3 o'clock Eastern time today. He'll be a placeholder that'll be here for 9 months while Oklahomans have an election, and to be able to determine who'll be there for the next 6-year term. So that will come up actually this fall. I anticipate that will be Kevin Hearn, quite frankly, the first district congressman from Tulsa, is who I think will win that. But right now it'll be Alan Armstrong for the next 9 months, who's a great guy, energy guy from Tulsa area, ran a great company called the Williams Company, literally rose to the ranks, started out as a civil engineer, rose to the ranks of the company. He just recently retired, and the governor snapped him up and said, hey, don't go into retirement yet. We need your help still.
Yeah, and it looks like Dan Rooney, the founder of Folds of Honor, will look to fill Kevin Hearn's seat.
Yeah, well, we've got multiple folks. There's probably 7 or 8 folks that have already filed to be able to run for that first district seat in Tulsa. So it's going to be a great seat. And as you know, your radio program is very popular in Tulsa. And so there'll be a lot of folks that will be tuning into you to be able to track what's actually happening there.
Absolutely. A lot going on in Oklahoma. Some great people there and extremely patriotic. Thanks, like yourself. Senator James Lankford, thanks so much. Get that deal done.
We will get it done. We want to get our TSA folks and everybody else paid again. This is ridiculous. We should never have shutdowns.
All right. Thanks so much, Senator. Appreciate it. When we come back, your turn to talk. 1-866-408-7669. Then we talk about the actual fight, taking the Kish Island, Carb Island. Good, is that possible in the Strait of Hormuz? We'll talk to Lieutenant Colonel Alan West about that. You'll listen to the Brian Kilmeade Show.
Keeping you informed, engaged, and always a step ahead. It's the Brian Kilmeade Show. Join Fox in supporting our troops. From daily needs to global emergencies, help us be there for those who serve. Visit go.fox/Red Cross to donate to service to the armed forces today. His mouth to your ears. It's Brian Kilmeade.
It's good that the terrorist regime, their military has been, and capabilities have been degraded radically. The question, Mike, though, is political. It's the political question. No. What is the political impact? What's the impact in the Straits? What's the impact in the region?
Joe, in all due respect, if you ask the American people, if you have the choice of degrading the military structure in Iran, but having gasoline be $6 a gallon,
right,
and our economy falling into a deep recession where millions lose their job, what do you think of that?
Senator, you're not listening to me. That's the political side.
No, it's not political.
Okay.
It's a consequence,
right,
just like Mika said.
All right, why don't we talk about the Yankees, because you're not following me here.
I am
with
following
all due
you.
Respect.
I just don't agree with you.
Well, what, you don't understand me. There's a big difference.
And it's totally true. Do you understand? He knows the danger. He used to be pro-Israel. He knows the danger in the area. He's been around since the 80s. Congress then takes that Senate seat from Al D'Amato. He knows about Iran. He knows the dangers of Iran. He didn't sign on to the Iranian deal. It wasn't strong enough. And now he says, I'm worried about $6 a gallon gas. Wait a second. Are you not seeing the benefit to taking down one of the world's leading terror states that continues to chant death to America and act on it? As they say, it's not a slogan, it's a policy. So for you not to say, I'm glad it's degraded, you could say, I think a logical point would be, I worry about our munitions, I worry about the interceptor refills, I worry about things to that nature. But to not see the benefit to degrading Iran in the area, especially after a weekend in which they have the intermediate risk of missiles that are out there, and they've basically tried to bomb all their Arab neighbors and our assets in the region. So good luck with that. I mean, their true colors are showing, and so are Chuck Schumer's. Meanwhile, direct talks between the U.S. and Iran are on ending the war are not happening. But guess what? Indirect talks are taking place. And guess who's helping us? Pakistan is helping us. Egypt is helping us, not a surprise. And you have Qatar also trying. And I also saw this report in the Institute of Study of War, which I encourage everyone to subscribe to, that two unspecified sources told Israel media that Iran has decided to limit its attacks on Saudi Arabia due to concerns that the continued strikes could trigger a direct Saudi military response. Understand what they're telling you. The only thing that can limit them, the only thing they understand, is strength. And if the Saudis are going to show strength, they have no fear of the UAE. They're not worried about Qatar, not worried about Bahrain, clearly not worried about Kuwait. But wait a second. If I get the Saudis involved, that's going to be problematic. Now, hitting their assets in the Red Sea, a port by the Red Sea, that's not good. They also have a pipeline, which everyone said was stays. You don't need a pipeline. You got the Strait of Hormuz. He goes, I need a pipeline just to make sure. And they got a pipeline. So there is oil getting out from Saudi Arabia. They have to plan for this. They could never, nobody can, you can never, as long as the Iranians have any type of control over the Strait of Hormuz, we have to have a plan B, because it's impossible that terror nation to have this much leverage around the world. When we come back, I'm going to be joined by Lieutenant Colonel Alan West. More on that, Brian Kilmeade.
This is Ainsley Earhart. Thank you for joining me for the 52-episode podcast series, The Life of Jesus.
A listening experience that will provide hope, comfort, and understanding of the greatest story ever told. Listen and follow now at foxnewspodcasts.com or wherever you listen to podcasts.
Talk show that's real. This is the Brian Kilmeade Show.
What are the things that worry you about Apple's product impact on society?
Well, I don't want people using them too much. Mm-hmm. I don't want people looking at the smartphone more than they're looking in someone's eyes. As if they're just scrolling endlessly. This is not the way you want to spend your day. Go out and spend it in nature.
So that's interesting. The CEO of Apple, the man who succeeded its founder, Steve Jobs, said, don't want you on it too much. Look, I think this is a guy waiting for the results of that social media trial, which I think it's 8 days so far. The jury has not come up with a verdict on if it's guilty, if they're some of these social media apps like Meta are guilty of addicting people to their products. And Tim Cook is making it clear, I don't want you doing it too much. Look, I know that's a little counterproductive, and although some of these internal documents show the longer you're on the phone, the more money they make, it obviously is that. I mean, you're getting enough money. They're nickel and diming you to death. If you're an Apple user, yeah, how many times you get these these notices that they just charged you? For what? You know, in the middle of the month. But Tim Cook is saying that. Do you think he's saying that just for the public knowledge? Do you think secretly he does want us on there all day?
I don't think he does really want us there. I mean, he wants the company to do well, but I think probably at this point he wants society to do better overall.
It's really a comeuppance. I don't know anyone who doesn't even feel guilty. Let's say you're with somebody. How many times, like in the past, they're scrolling and now mm-hmm. If you're scrolling in front of somebody, turning your back on them.
It's like giving you the middle finger. Yeah. It enrages me.
And how about this? You go out to dinner. Most people will say, I just got to answer this quick. There used to be no problem, go out, answer. Now people are saying, it's almost like saying, excuse me, I got to use the restroom, or I got to go check my car for something. So I think people are realizing the etiquette and how bad it is when you're hanging out with people and they're just on their phones. They're saying, hey, I know I'm with you, but I'd rather talk to somebody else. Unless it's an emergency, which
sometimes, you know, if you have a babysitter, yeah, you need to have it out in case something happens.
But don't you feel like you had to make an excuse if you have to text at dinner? Let's say you're out to dinner with friends. Do you feel like if you look at your phone and have to text back, do you feel like, I just got to answer this?
No, sometimes I'll say it's a new babysitter with my kids. Like, I just need to keep the phone out. So in case they need to call, right? Knowing that I'm sort of the person, the emergency contact, so to speak.
Yeah. So you have to answer your call. I think we're learning a little bit from that. So there's a couple other things going on besides the war and besides illegal immigration we've discussed. I also think that you got a situation where we're probably more people are angrier about this DHS shutdown and what they're doing to lines. I saw someone interviewed yesterday in Atlanta that waited for 5 hours and still missed their plane. Can you imagine this? 5 hours and still missed your plane. And you're doing this not because there's some major impasse and philosophical change, and it's not because they can't agree on the budget, which I thought was terrible in the fall for 44 days, but this is total throwing a tantrum, pure politics. I don't like the way ICE is acting. I want to show my constituents, my voters, I'm tough, so I will not fund them, and I'll have ridiculous demands to fund them. So the president yesterday linked the passing of the Save America Act with this. He has since changed his tune to a degree. In case you do not know, Fox has learned two high-ranking officials involved in negotiations last night, they hung up with the president at 1 in the morning, and they agreed, fund the DHS, don't fund ICE. We will fund ICE through a reconciliation bill, which means a simple majority in both House and Senate, at which time we'll also fund the Save America Act. Now, you might be saying, why do the Save America Act since it's not going to get 60 votes? Well, we get 50, and then they'll put it on the books, and what they'll do is fund it, and in the fall, when they do another reconciliation package, which they fully expect, you can tag that onto it. Now, what do we mean in terms of getting votes for it? Reconciliation, you only need a simple majority. Unless you have someone making a stand like Mitch McConnell or Murkowski, or if Collins is up, you know, you can use a couple. Collins is up and it would be bad for us politically. It's most likely going to be extremely tough fight. I think that that passes again. So what they're doing is showing a lot of flexibility, elasticity in order to pass everything. Here's Tom Holman, Cut 17, on ICE helping out now without masks at airports. Cut 17.
Donald Trump made a brilliant move this week, and he called me and says, let's send ICE at the airport. I thought it was a smart move. And we're filling the holes. The wait lines already dropped. Plus, we're doing a security function at the airports. We're going to arrest criminals going through this airport. We're going to look for human trafficking, sex trafficking, money smuggling. We're going to be at the airports working with our brothers and sisters of TSA. There are our brothers and sisters within DHS. President Trump made a smart move. We're going to keep the airplanes flying. We're going to get the American people to those lines quicker, and we're not going to give up President Trump's promise to American people to make this country safer every day, and that's what we're going to keep doing.
So, Senators, Hakeem Jeffries said some outrageous, you're not going to believe this, when he heard that ICE is going to be deployed, and by the way, a brilliant move by the president, because ICE is an in-your-face to Democrats, so you're shutting down the TSA to send a message on ICE, so why don't we just go send the ICE where TSA agents should be? Listen to how outrageous Hakeem Jeffries was over the weekend. Cut 22.
The last thing that the American people need are for untrained ICE agents to be deployed at airports all across the country, potentially to brutalize or in some instances kill them. We've already seen how ICE conducts itself. These are untrained individuals when it comes to doing the current job that they have for the most part, let alone deploying them in close exposure in highly sensitive situations at airports across the country.
So this is law enforcement, you clown. And for you to say that, you're saying potentially to brutalize for what? When people ask to show ID, to brutalize? When they have to hunt down illegal immigrants, sometimes they have to get a little rough. You try it instead of letting them all in. And in some instances, kill them? So you think ICE is going to run around, tackle people randomly and shoot them in the head? Is that what you're inferring? Cory Booker, not much better. Cut 21.
And so what's happening today in America that should outrage everybody? He's taking the very same agency that has been bursting into our schools, into our churches, into our hospitals, into our courts, and even into the homes of Americans. He's taking that agency that is reckless and out of control and bringing them to our airports. Under the lie that somehow this is going to help deal with the long lines that he created in the first place. This is an outrage.
Those are the lines that you created in the first place. You decide to defund, to send a message about Minneapolis. The fix has already been in. And now you continue to stand there and pressure Chuck Schumer. You're still going to try to get rid of Chuck Schumer, by the way, Cory Booker. Now, what about the president sending people into hospitals and churches? No, that's Don Lemon and those outrageous idiots in Minneapolis who burst into a church. Just incredible what these people get away with. And there's no follow-up question. They just sit there like mummies. Don't say a word about it. Tom Holman on all this, cut 18.
Why would any member of Congress, why would any member of Congress defund the Transportation Security Administration that protects our skies? Why would they defund Coast Guard? Why would they defund CISA against cyber attacks? Why would they defund FEMA? I mean, you're talking about not funding the Department of Homeland Security, which is their number one responsibility as a representative in Congress, to protect this country. And they're voting not to protect this country.
It's true. It's absolutely true. And think if there's a terror attack. That's why I like that the president walked back. He said, I'm not going to vote to end the shutdown unless the Save America Act is passed. And overnight and yesterday in the evening, he met with senators and his new secretary. And they said, listen, it's probably not a good idea because now it looks like Republicans are holding out for no deal when it's clearly Democrats that decided not to fund something the Appropriations Committee assumed and the body already okayed. And that was ICE funding. So in case you do not know, ICE is not going to get funded. They're going to find a way to do it through reconciliation. And there's enough money with the big, beautiful bill to fund it through 2028. No problem. So they're not going to have any changes to ICE and their procedure. They'll do it because Secretary Mullins wants to do it, not because it's agreed with the Democrats. Because you didn't fund it. You lost all your leverage. So don't fund it. Fund the rest. And now Republicans will do what they want with ICE. And I know if a Democrat gets in, they got to do what Biden did. Basically cut it down to a small nominal force that will allow illegal immigrant criminals to run wild. Like they did in Chicago when they killed that 18-year-old at 1:30 in the morning. Like they did in Virginia when they killed that when a man with seven prior arrests assassinated another girl, Jennifer Minter, in Virginia. You listen to the Brian Kilmeade Show. Back with you in just a moment.
Coming to you on a need-to-know basis, because, man, do you need to know. It's Brian Kilmeade. A radio show like no other. It's Brian Kilmeade.
I appreciate that so many progressives are leaning into the redefining what pro-life is really about, and that's what we're doing in California. You know, pro-life is about prenatal care and universal preschool and universal after school and universal health care and, you know, taking care of foster kids and feeding, you know, universal meals and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, child care. Like, that's pro-life. It's not conception.
Okay. You could have both. I don't know if the first lady is happy with that comment, if that's going to help her husband's campaign. Maybe it'll help in a primary, but I don't think in a general. Number two is everybody wants to help foster kids. Everybody wants to help kids that need in need. But you can't fund an entire state's preschool, health care. That's what they do, including illegals. You can't fund foster care, and you can't do pre-K. I mean, it's impossible. And daycare. Look, everybody knows these are huge expenses, but states are going bankrupt because they overcommit. So what they do is they jack up tax rates, and then people head for the hills. Do you know, there was another billionaire that just left Silicon Valley about 2 weeks before the end of the year. Why? Because they're about to vote in a billionaire's tax. Everyone's getting out of California. And now the House Oversight Committee is launching a probe into rampant hospice fraud. Do you think about how ugly this is? It's hospice. These are houses that allow you to live the last days of your life out with dignity, usually a very painful situation. Can you believe these people that try to take advantage of social services like autism and others and Feed America programs like Minneapolis and California? But hospices is as evil as it gets, too. California is being investigated by this committee after the New York Post and California Post exposed rampant hospice fraud that cost taxpayers $100 million at least. The House Oversight Committee had sent shockwaves through California when they did this. And if Gavin Newsom keeps coming out saying, I'm cracking down on all this myself, I don't need you. Yes, you need him. You go after the guys looking into this. You don't go after the actual fraudsters. James Comer wrote this. The committee is concerned your administration, Gavin Newsom, does not have sufficient internal controls to prevent and detect fraud and is not conducting proper oversight of these hospice programs. As a result, Americans across the country are paying for California's rampant hospice fraud, and vulnerable patients are being exploited. So Gavin Newsom, who never sees an opportunity not to take a shot at Trump or Republicans, not saying, hey, I appreciate you cracking down on fraud. I'm doing all I can, or whatever the situation might be. Here's what he writes. In 2021, Gavin Newsom signed legislation placing a moratorium on new hospice licenses, a policy that remains in effect today, preventing bad actors from entering the system while strengthening oversight of existing providers. This work is delivering results as more than 280 hospice licenses have been revoked over the past 2 years. An initial 300 providers are under investigation. 300 providers. How much more do you need? 280 closed, 300 under investigation. What real hospice is out there? By the way, Gavin Newsom, among California voters, they have him number one for 2028 and Kamala Harris number two. But among, I couldn't believe this, the one who's leading the California governor's race is Eric Swalwell. This is crazy. This guy's an unaccomplished, clownish congressman with no experience leading any organization, let alone a mammoth state. Second is Steve Hilton, the Republican. The top two have a runoff. So that'll be a runoff. It'll be very hard for a Republican to win. You want two Republicans to ascend to that level. The guy that I thought would be good, Matt Mahan, has got all Silicon Valley's support. He's a Democrat, yes, but so-called moderate. He's got something like 85% approval in San Jose County, which is huge county. So I thought he'd have a shot, but evidently still in single digits, not resonating with the people. I'm not sure what people don't like about him. Maybe California doesn't want anyone moderate. Is that possible? They feel as though they're effective this way? Really? So if you look at the other presidential contenders, Gavin Newsom's one. Kamala Harris seems to be two in most polls. Mayor Pete is going to be running. Governor Shapiro is going to be running. Governor Beshear is going to be running. Rahm Emanuel is going to be running. He's running for already right now. I mean, there's going to be some other surprises. Cory Booker wrote a book. Every time they write a book about yourself again, Cory Booker is definitely going to put himself in there. He thinks he's going to be running. And if they're not, they feel like they could be number two on the ticket. But these people don't resonate. They didn't resonate the first time. Mayor Pete is growing a beard, taking his pronouns down, meeting with black audiences. I don't know. What are you saying? You have nowhere with the black community. They're not convinced that you can lead. You've been a bad mayor, and you've been a terrible Secretary of Transportation. Gavin Newsom's been a terrible governor. The one that gets higher marks, got elected twice in a Republican state, Governor Beshear, but all his policies seem left-wing when I see him. He seems unreasonable, but at least you could say I'm popular in Kentucky. I can win nationally. Governor Shapiro is about to win again as governor. At least you could say, well, I'm popular in Pennsylvania, battleground state. I got a shot nationally. At least you could say he's got a track record that he's proud of. I mean, Gavin Newsom just makes stuff up, like California's got lower taxes than Florida, and then people just hear that and go, okay. I mean, you know that's not true. I think it's fascinating to see what else is going on. These blue states find themselves unable to balance their books because of these generous pension programs, because of these extremely generous social programs, and they are chasing successful people out of their states by taxing them to death and vilifying them verbally. So you have the New York City mayor going out, I'm going to raise property taxes on the estate tax. I'm going to knock it down to $750,000. Okay, I'm leaving. Gotta leave. So if you make, you know, if you're lucky enough to make millions of dollars in your life and be able to save that, and you want to leave that because you probably work, I don't know, 50, 60 hours a week for 50 years. And you say, I want some legacy for my family. Why would you stay in one of these states with these extremely high estate taxes? Why would you even consider doing it? I mean, it's almost irresponsible. You got to say to yourself, do you hate your family? Do you dislike them? Because do you want to give your money into that abyss called the state? So there's something going on here. Chicago's raising taxes. Washington State's raising taxes. Massachusetts at a huge deficit. I think they're losing more billionaires than anybody else. But they have a huge government gap too, financial gap as well. And everyone's moving to red states. Now, the fear was when Governor Perry was governor of Texas that you've over-recruited. You're recruiting a lot of Democrats to come there and be Democrats. I don't know if that's a fear anymore. I mean, do you really think someone's going to leave a high tax state to go to another low tax state and then vote for someone who's going to jack up the taxes? That's going to put all your money into social programs and vilify rich, successful people? I'm telling you, most rich people do not inherit their money. I think the number is like 70% are first-time success stories. Listen to the Brian Kilmeade Show. Go to BrianKilmeade.com and see my big fall and summer tour. I want to see you in person.
News radio studios in Midtown Manhattan. It's the fastest growing radio talk show. Brian Kilmeade.
Hi, everyone. Brian Kilmeade, thanks so much for being here. We have a lot going on this hour. We're going to be joined by Khosrow Dasbani, the research for director of Union for Democracy in Iran. And Jim Murphy's going to be with us to lift you up and inspire you, a performance coach to an extraordinary athletes and leaders, hopefully make a difference in your life. And then we do a simulcast with the great Stuart Varney on FBN. Let's get to the big three.
Number three.
It's just another one. If they would simply just work with ICE, if their law enforcement would work with ICE when they arrest illegal aliens for crimes, we could save countless lives in this country.
Why is that so hard? Two more illegal immigrants with criminal records kill Americans in the state of Virginia and Illinois, in my view, are ultimately to blame. Why the president has to drive this message home to fix this once and for all. That's how he got elected and would give momentum back to him in the immigration debate.
Number two.
What we can do is pass the rest. We can put pay the TSA workers and the rest of the Department of Homeland Security, and then do what we did this last summer, which is pass another reconciliation bill that will not only fund ICE, but do so without handcuffing them and limiting their ability to enforce our immigration laws.
Senator Cornyn, join me on Fox and Friends earlier. The Senate Republicans believe they found a path to end the five-week DHS shutdown after meeting with President Trump on Monday and having a conversation with Chuck Schumer. I'll bring you the latest.
We're giving it 5 days, and then we're going to see where that takes us. And I would say at the end of this period, I think it could very well end up being a very good deal for everybody.
Yes, that is President Trump surprising many that saying talks are progressing with Iran. I'm not convinced that these talks are going to produce anything. I don't think they're going anywhere because this death cult has nowhere to go. Use the Marines to reopen the strait and finish off these thugs for good of the world. That's what I believe. So it turns out that the speaker, the parliamentary speaker, is the one speaking with Pakistan and Egypt and Turkey emissaries, the foreign minister in Turkey taking the lead in order to talk to the U.S., Israel, mostly the U.S., about ending the violence and, between the two countries. But judging by the rhetoric, I don't think we're close. And unless they said to us, okay, no more ballistic missiles, we're not going to make them, we'll let you take down the manufacturing, all right, and then we're going to let you go get the uranium out of those two sites, 450 kilograms, we'll bring in the heavy equipment, we'll watch you do it, or you can watch us do it. And then don't touch the strait, internationalize it right away. Unless those things are done, and still I have trouble taking them at their word, I don't know if you stop this. Because you're never going to get Israel and the U.S. at this time without an election with the right president to take this action over a perennial enemy. Khusro Isfahani joins us now, Research Director for the National Union for Democracy in Iran. Khusro, thanks so much for joining us.
Hi, thanks for having me.
All right, let me take a seat so we can both be seen on Zoom. Your thoughts about why we haven't seen more people rise up in the streets, especially this weekend when you were celebrating Persian New Year?
There are two sides to that story. One, President Trump, Prime Minister Netanyahu, and the leader of the opposition, Crown Prince Reza Pahlavi, has repeatedly called on the people to remain in their homes safe while the bombs are falling around. That message has been repeated multiple times by President Trump, and Iranians are good at listening to the leader of the free world. Maybe some people elsewhere don't listen to him. We do. That's one. Two, you mentioned Nowruz. Last week, we also celebrated Chaarshanbe Suri, the Persian Fire Festival. After a call from Reza Pahlavi, people celebrated this festival in their neighborhoods, chanting, shouting against the Islamic Republic, despite threats from the regime that if they do, they will be killed. And they did that because we have absolute trust in the help that has arrived, the help that the United States President promised us has arrived. When the regime dispatched militias to kill the people, they were hit by drone strikes from Israel. They never got to these neighborhoods to kill and maim and torture and rape my people. So people are back on the streets.
So is the internet up?
And on and off, there is limited access. The nationwide internet shutdown is still in place. But by paying hefty sums of money, people can get special VPNs that help them get around the blockade. There also are a ton of satellite internet devices smuggled into the country by dissidents that are being used for operational activity rather than normal communication.
How much of the Basra, are you in contact with people in Iran? Sounds like you are.
Yes.
So how present is the plainclothes police, the Basra, how close are they? I mean, how many are there? Are they still out in the streets showing enforcement?
So two parts about the Basij militia. When the war was starting, they started setting up checkpoints across the country, intimidating people, shooting at them, issuing threats. And then Israel started mowing the lawn with targeted drone strikes. At least 300 Basij militia members have been taken out already, at least. Many more have been injured, and many, many more are not showing up to their their posts because they are scared of these drone strikes. Some of them move the checkpoints under the bridges, but the beauty of a drone is that it can fly under a bridge as well. So those checkpoints were also taken out. So a lot of them are scared, and even when they show up, they cannot access food and water because the regime has no means to deliver these basic services to its killing machine. So they are sleeping hungry on the street.
Wow. So that's good news. How big is that force? You said 300 are gone. Is there like tens of thousands of them?
Yes, there are tens of thousands of them. But the thing is, all of them were in this game not because of ideology, but for an easy paycheck. When you face this increasing, rising, terrifying cost, a paycheck is not that valuable. And they know that. And many of them have stopped showing up because the paycheck is not even arriving. The banking system is collapsing. The regime doesn't have money to pay these thugs. And they have family. Their family doesn't want them dead, at least I hope so. And a side effect of this fear, these strikes, is that actively they are defecting, not just from the bottom of the food chain, these besieged militiamen, but also from the top. Military and security personnel are defecting. The United States has documented it. Secretary of War Hegseth has talked about it. The diaspora has been pushing for it for years. It's happening.
Khosrow, tell me about your story.
Which part of it you would like to know?
What is your heritage, and where are your parents born?
So my parents both were born and raised in Tehran, same as me. They were both activists. After the revolution, my dad was jailed for 4 years for involvement in campaigns against the Islamic Republic. He randomly survived mass executions because he got out of jail because his prison sentence was up 6 months before the regime killed tens of thousands of political prisoners and dumped their bodies in mass graves. I grew up with stories of these brave young men and women who tried to make Iran into a better place, and they were killed in cold blood without even having a court hearing. I grew up with those stories. And my parents trained me to fight this fight from an early age, from teaching me urban warfare to how to navigate urban spaces in face of security forces and surveillance. I got involved more and more with politics. The first rally I went to, I was 9. My dad thought it's a good idea to take his son to a protest, despite seeing all the atrocities that this regime commits. But properly, I got involved with politics in Iran in 2009 when I was 19 years old, and the Green Movement was happening in Iran in response to a fraudulent election, and after that it has been just escalation after escalation. I have put my hand in too many cookie jars that the Islamic Republic didn't like, from documenting the Quds Force activities to its missile program to atrocities it has committed against people in my homeland and elsewhere. I made my way into secretive missile bases without the right credentials, with someone else's ID card. I have done interesting things in Iran until 2021, when I had to leave the country because the heat was rising, and the last interrogation I was called in was with a deputy minister, not a random interrogator. So I left the country and kept going at the regime.
And you're young, you look like a young guy. So yeah, you took tremendous risk in country. So would you say you're in touch with how many people in Iran?
As much as possible.
Would you say 50 people? Would you say 20, 10?
Way more than that.
More than
that. The issue is I have a public profile with clear political stances aligned with the United States and Israel. I'm an outspoken person that supports President Trump and this military operation for taking out the Islamic Republic. What I do is I have an active network in the United States, in Europe, of collectives of activists who have a mesh in country and are pulling information constantly out for me.
Right.
It's not a single man job. When you are the research director at an Iranian American institution like NUFTI, you build a structure that can be resilient even when you face an internet shutdown, even when you lose a single person, a single source.
So I know President Trump said, wait, you know, be ready when it's time. But I feel without guns, you're always going to be outgunned. Is there a mission to arm people that want freedom to be able to fight for it in a fair way? Right now, it's you got your body, your will, your determination, and they got the guns.
There is two parts to my answer to your question. Some parts I cannot delve deep into because of operational security. But first part, we are watching one of the most advanced, technologically equipped revolutions in humans' history. The type of technologies that have been deployed in Iran, hopefully someday after this revolution succeeds, I can sit down with you and actually give you the details. The technologies that we have deployed, our allies have deployed in Iran, are not just drones, are way more sophisticated and are mind-boggling for the Islamic Republic. They don't know even these technologies exist. They don't know. And that's the beauty of it. Two, help is being delivered from the sky consistently. The arms of oppression of this regime has been dismantled to great extent. Its leadership has been weakened. It is acting on brain, on muscle memory instead of acting using a brain right now. With leadership removed, this is muscle memory of the Islamic Republic behaving. No strategy, no tactic, just repeating the past patterns. So, with the strikes from the sky, with the willingness of the people in Iran who have been trained, who have received training in advance and are prepared to take to the streets, big things are going to happen in that country. When the January uprising happened, when millions of people took to the streets with a clear chant repeating the name of Crown Prince Reza Pahlavi, one thing that happened in Iran was the lion and sun flag in hundreds were displayed on the streets. Those flags don't grow on trees. I have videos from a year ago of women sewing those flags in their homes.
Is that the Shah flag? That's the Shah flag?
Yes. That's the easiest part. Many more things like that have been happening over the past year. Iranians are ready. We are the boots on the ground. And many of us in diaspora are also ready to be dispatched to the front line for the final battle for dismantling the Islamic Republic and reclaiming our homeland.
So we know about the jacking up of the prices. By the way, they're getting reports now that people are paying extortion to countries, $2 million in order to pass through the Strait of Hormuz. And it looks like many ships are beginning to pass through. Up to $2 million. I'm glad they're passing through, but to pay extortion helps the regime. But just to know what the president's up against, he's worried about the economic headwinds, and also Democrats with this attitude. Cut five. Ro Khanna.
This has been the biggest blunder in American foreign policy in the 21st century, and that's saying something. What have we achieved? Iran still has enriched uranium that's buried underneath. They've replaced Khamenei with Khamenei Jr. By the way, Khamenei, the older one, had a fatwa saying, I don't want to build nuclear weapons. The younger son doesn't have that fatwa.
Right.
We have gas shooting up to almost $7 where I am in California, but across the country, 30% up. They didn't plan that Iran would shoot ships in the Strait of Hormuz. Like, who is planning this? So they have created utter chaos, and the American people see that.
What is your thought about that congressman from California?
Two parts. One, Ro Khanna is absolutely arrogant, ill-informed, and out of his depth. He talks about the fatwa that the Supreme Leader has issued. I have studied Khamenei for over a decade. I have documented everything that that man has done. That fatwa doesn't exist. That was a lie. I have written extensively about it. You can check up the article on Atlantic Council. The fatwa that didn't exist. It didn't exist. How many times these Democrats are going to repeat a single lie to sell a horrible deal that President Obama signed with this genocidal terrorist state? That's point one. Two, it takes a lot of gall for people like Ro Khanna to criticize President Trump when they backed an auto pen. Get over yourself. President Trump has put where United States should have always been. He's defending the United States national interest and has the stomach to weather the storms that are coming his way. Yes, the Islamic Republic is a threat, but it has always been a threat. And there is one way to deal with this threat: absolute annihilation or total surrender. Anything in between will be another absolute Obama move, another Biden mistake, and it will lead to more American lives lost, more American benefits lost, and many more disasters.
I hope people understand you. You've done your work. That is the story on the ground, which we don't get enough of. Khosrow Isfahani, thanks so much. Research Director for the National Union for Democracy in Iran. I hope to talk to you from Tehran one day, a peaceful Tehran that's a friend to the country. Thanks so much.
Hopefully soon. Thanks.
Back in a moment.
Coming to you on a need-to-know basis, because man, do you need to know. It's Brian Kilmeade. The more you listen, the more you'll know. It's Brian Kilmeade.
I tell you, I went way long, and I apologize. This will be a short segment. But Khosrow Isfahani, I learned more about what's happening on the ground from him in that 15 minutes than I've learned in almost every broadcast. I'm going to be watching Middle Eastern news with closed captions just to get the latest on the ground. And there's almost nothing. And I just learned more about what's happening. And, you know, you got to go on his word, but the contacts are there and the credibility's there. I've watched some other channels, and that's why I asked for him to come on. He was on one of the Middle Eastern channels. But, man, was that interesting. There's a lot going on the ground. 300 of the besieged guys are dead. Many of them are afraid to come into the neighborhoods. They've already celebrated the Fire Festival and New Year's. And on the go sign, they'll come out and fight. Would not say whether or not they're armed, but to me that shows there's a movement to arm them.
If you're interested in it, Brian's talking about it. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
Welcome back. Joining us in studio, if you're smart enough to get the stream, you can get on your app. Jim Murphy, performance coach to extraordinary athletes and leaders around the world, and author of Inner Excellence. It's his new book, Train Your Mind for Extraordinary Performance and the Best Possible Life. And he also has a book, The Best Possible Life, which is a bestseller. Great to see you, Jim.
Thanks for having me.
So when did you go from an aspiring baseball player, major leaguer, to somebody that wanted to focus on performance and help others?
Well, my whole identity was wrapped up in my career as a baseball player. And when I lost it, I felt like I lost everything. And so I ended up, I was driving a truck for FedEx and ended up moving to the desert to live a life of solitude to figure out what to do with my life. And that's where I decided to become a personal coach to pro baseball players and teach them how to have peace and confidence under pressure. And then that Inner Excellence came out of that, 5 years of full-time writing and research, 50 to 60 hours a week.
So do you think that your performance would have been better had you had this stuff mastered when you were in your 20s and 30s?
Oh, no doubt. You know, the thing that it's so important to understand if you want to help anybody, including yourself, is to understand the human heart. And the human heart is created for relationship, and our greatest need is unconditional love and love and connection. Are created for relationships, and our greatest fear is rejection of that connection. So most people will spend their entire lives trying to get more of what I call the acronym POMS: possessions, achievements, looks, money, and status, so they can feel good, so they walk into a social situation and they can feel okay.
And when people find out if it's money and status, they usually feel like when they get both or all of it, do they feel as though that is this all there is?
Oh, yeah. It's an empty chase your tail existence.
Right. And when did you realize that? When you went to study it?
Yeah. I mean, I was just like anyone else. I was obsessed with being a superstar. I thought, you know, I'm going to have the best possible life, and that's going to be one where every girl wants to be with me, every guy wants to be me, I'm going to make millions of dollars, and that's going to be my life. And then I get injured, and I lost it. And right. So what I've realized is what I've always really wanted is to feel fully alive.
And you started just your baseball career at Portland State. You went to college, and then you went drafted by the Cubs?
Yeah, that's right.
And how long did you last with the Cubs organization?
I was there 3 years, got injured, went and played college football, and then two more years of pro baseball.
Right, and then when you were done, you went out to seek more. And what did you discover? When did you realize there was performance science out there, number one, and number two is that you wanted to learn more and make it your living?
When I was a teenager, my coach told me about sports psychology, so I've been interested any way to get me to become a superstar. I was really interested, and so sports psychology has been an interest of mine since I was a teenager. But yeah, I left for the desert to try and figure out what can I devote my life to, because I've always had kind of an obsessive personality. I've wanted to be a superstar when I was a little kid. And in that time in the desert, I realized that two things that are really crucial. One is that your heart is the key to your life, your spirit, your will. We got to get much deeper than your thoughts. We're far more than thinking machines. And then two is that the path to the most peace and confidence under the most pressure is the same path to creating the best possible life, a life of deep contentment, joy, and confidence. And that's a wholehearted path. You have to train the whole person.
Right. So you have to get on a mission. So the minute you have a purpose and a mission, and I think a lot of it is, it's a job to find out what that is, correct?
Yeah.
You can't wait for it to hit you.
Oh, for sure. Well, there's some things that we know about all of us, and that we're created for a purpose beyond ourselves, and we're created for relationship.
Right. So tell me some of the conclusions that make up the axioms that make up your beliefs.
Yeah, for sure. Selfless is fearless. Self-centeredness is the greatest challenge that we face in performance and in life. I'm a performance coach. I've been doing this for several decades, and so I get paid to get people to perform better. So it's not something you're going to hear from a lot of performance coaches or sports psychologists, this idea that self-centeredness is the biggest challenge we face. But thinking about yourself...
Especially baseball. In baseball, you have to... It's a team sport, but it's an individual sport.
Well, people come to me and they want more confidence, and really what they need is more presence. But self-centeredness leads to fear. You the more you think about yourself, the more you're going to get caught up in your weaknesses and mistakes.
So tell me some of the things you should do to prepare to succeed.
Well, I think when you think about the whole selfless is fearless idea, it's really... learn and grow is the number one goal that we all have. Every single client, every inner excellence practitioner is to learn and grow every single day. And within that, we have four daily goals. And the first one is to give the best of what you have, 100% of what you got that day. And some days it's not going to be very good, and that's okay. You have to understand that. Number two is to be fully present. There's no fear or anxiety in the present moment, only possibilities. Number three is to be grateful. Gratitude is directly linked to inner peace, which is directly linked to inner strength.
And you say at the end of a day, you should think about all the things that happened positive that day. Take a few minutes every day and take account, right?
At the end of the day, you want to go through your day and look at what was great and connect with that and fix any mistakes in your mind so you don't keep dwelling on it. And so you want to fix the mistake in your mind. Go back and do what you would have done for next time, so your subconscious doesn't carry it to bed.
Right. And then that's at the end of the day. How do you start your day?
Oh, you need to start your day with space and solitude. You need to get to a place of clarity in your mind. Like for me, and every human heart, the greatest need is for love. And so I have 10 minutes a day where I start off with put my countdown timer 10 to 20 minutes. I'm going to put on some Christian music for me, and then I'm just going to soak up God's love. I have a mantra that I get from a friend of mine, Ken Chigamatsu, that's Jim, you are my beloved in whom I delight. And so those are the words I focus on in the morning.
And do you relay that to all your clients?
Yeah, every
morning.
Do you say
this is what Jim Murphy does, or do you say this is what I want you to do?
I do both. Well, what I'm going to say is if I was working with you, for example, I would say, here's what I do, what I'm learning, and I'm going to share with you what you're going to work on, and we're going to work on this together. I'm not the teacher. I'm here. We're both students learning the same thing. I want to live with fullness of life. You want to live with fullness of life. We both have minds that have negative thoughts and limiting beliefs, and so we're going to work on it together.
So when you look at some of these teams, we were in the middle of the NCAA tournament. We're up to the Sweet 16.
That's right.
And you're going to see, and we saw the USA hockey team, and we saw a lot of the success they're having. Do you see some commonality in that? And if you were working in the team concept, How do you get people, like, for example, High Point pulls off this huge upset?
Yeah.
Psychologically, they're not intimidated by these established programs. They weren't intimidated in the game they lost to Arkansas. They almost won that one. There's some clues in that.
Yeah, for sure. Well, the March Madness is such a great example. These guys are going to, the young kids are going to have feelings that they're not used to. And that can be very scary if you don't know what to do with the feelings. But the most important thing is to understand that I need to embrace these feelings every single, if say you're playing for the national championship, the goal should be to fully experience the moment, embrace all the feelings that come, and realize that you're going to be uncomfortable. And that's important. And that's great. Don't run from being uncomfortable.
And probably the thing I'm in most awe of, like you score, if you're Michael Jordan, you're scoring 50 points a game at the highest level. I'm in awe of that, but I can't even relate to that type of athleticism. But I'm looking at this guy, Dylan Darling. He's playing for St. John's. He has not scored a point all game. The score is tied. There's 6 seconds left. He walks up to Rick Pitino and says, call my play. I want the ball. And Pitino goes, okay. He calls the play and goes, wait a second. You haven't scored all game. Just get me the ball. He asks for the ball under pressure. He gets the ball and scores with his opposite hands, his only 2 points of the game, sending St. John's to the Sweet 16 first time since 1999. Can you describe that mindset?
Well, that's why belief is... Michaela Schifrin just won a gold medal in skiing. And she said that belief is more powerful than confidence. And it's so true.
Confidence, what's the difference?
Confidence is the feeling that I can achieve this task. Belief is that I'm going to be okay no matter what. Belief is like, I'm the man. Confidence is like, I can do this right now. And so, but the problem with confidence is that, one, you can be careless, and two, you may do everything right and it may not work out. You may fail, you may lose, and you may not get what you want. But belief is a deeper sense of that everything's going to be okay.
I can't remember who said it, but someone was saying to me, I'm like, you know, at about 30 years old, they just began to excel in baseball. I'm trying to remember who told me, and he said one of the keys was, I stopped caring. And my sense is he stopped putting his identity and associating it with success or failure.
Yeah,
I'm going to go out there every day's with house money.
Yes, stop caring. That's a very common idea, and it's not a good strategy. It's can you get to the place where you're not attached to the result? You know, in golf, I'm sure if you golf, you probably know that when you're really attached to the result, it's really hard, and then you get a couple of really tough days, and then you're like, man, then you kind of stop caring. Then you can play well. Or it's the first round of the year, there's no expectations, you play well. But it's really about learning how to be fully present in the moment, not...
That's one thing I'm in awe baseball players at, because you really do have to forget every at-bat, don't you? I mean, I'm watching Aaron Judge not come up big again in the World Baseball Classic, as fantastic as he is, generational player, fantastic human being. But there's trouble producing in the clutch, it seems.
Yeah, in
but
the
he's still
in
able.
The past.
I don't see him throwing the bat, breaking it over his knee, keeps calm.
Yeah, and that's why the focus on the four daily goals, redefining success outside of the outcome. The fourth daily goal is to focus on your routines and only what you can control. And so that's super important, especially in baseball and in life.
Jim Murphy has written the book, The Best Possible Life, and his new one, Inner Excellence, Train Your Mind for Extraordinary Performance and the Best Possible Life. Jim, congratulations on all your success.
Thanks so much for having me.
And back in a moment. We come back simulcast with Stuart Varney and FBN. Don't move.
Diving deep into today's top stories, it's Brian Kilmeade. Now, the Brian Kilmeade Show joins Fox Business's Varney & Company with Stuart Varney, live on your radio and on Fox Business. Here's Brian Kilmeade.
Hi, everybody. Welcome back. We're going to do an FBN simulcast shortly. Then I'll be able to squeeze in some calls on the back end if you want to stay on board. That'll be great. We have a lot to discuss. Also, we're still following the story that a framework of a deal is done to reform and start to fund TSA, cybersecurity, Coast Guard, CISA, everything together, but not ICE. And ICE has got enough money, and then they're going to do a reconciliation package to fund it. But because Democrats are not going to fund ICE, they're not going to be able to reform ICE. But that's what Schumer's agreed to unless he backs out of it. Let's listen in.
Some 2028 Democrat hopefuls are talking about their childhood trauma. Seriously, watch this.
My father just took off, was sort of broken by two campaigns for local office. Mom and dad never talked about the reason they divorced, but also explained why my mom was so aggressively insistent that I not get into politics.
I had an unbelievably happy childhood.
Yes.
And at times, I think because of the trauma that my mother went through, it was an unhappy
because you're right.
My mother, who was an alcoholic, said, I want you to know that sometimes it probably feels to you like I don't love you because I'm not being a mother to you that I want to be. But I want you to understand this is a disease. I have a disease and I'm trying very hard to overcome it.
So, Brian, why are they talking like this? Is talking about childhood trauma a good election strategy?
Well, I do think you have to tell your personal story. I think if you exaggerate the personal story, I'm not saying they are. That's the problem. I mean, we find it a lot of times with Olympians, like, or with people in sports. They'll tell their story about where they came from, the rags to riches story. But it's really hard for me to look at, and I understand money doesn't bring happiness. But when you have Gavin Newsom continue to try to tell us that all he had was a loaf of bread and a piece of cheese when he grew up wealthy, and then you have the Pritzker, one of the wealthiest families in the country, and he's talking about, you know, stuff that he went through, and Governor Shapiro talks about his mom had mental illness. I guess it's part of the story. It's trying to make you likable and human. But I think that the pressure is going to come on to them if it comes off inauthentic, number one, and number two, not truthful or exaggerated. But we'll see. I mean, you do want to vote for the person. I mean, people voted for Trump as a person. People want to like you first and your policy second. A lot of times with me, Stuart, at this point, I want someone that's going to produce. They could be the most unlikable person in the world. I like to know they're a chief executive that can produce. And I like to know somebody that's going to be an effective leader. And then maybe when you do that story on 60 Minutes or on, you know, on Fox, then you get to a little bit depth of character. But they're laying the groundwork now to be human beings.
You got that right. The Christopher Columbus statue that Trump recently added near the White House, it is a replica of the one protesters tossed into Baltimore's harbor. That was back in 2020. You've been outspoken on this. Are you pleased to see the president bring back Columbus?
Absolutely, because I mean, the guy did a very courageous thing. Just read the story. You know, what he did and what they knew at the time and what he discovered changed the world. It was, they say in perspective, what Christopher Columbus did was like us going to the moon, only it was actually more dangerous to do what Columbus did, to keep the teams together and keep the crews together. And then when he landed, to make sense of what he saw. And what you'd read about Columbus is he wasn't the best leader. He was an explorer. You look at the impact he made and what he did. You don't judge him as if he was born in 2025 or 2010. And what kind of adult is he? And I don't want to emulate that. What you do is look at the generations he's in, the culture that he came from, and the impact that he had. We have to get back to that, or it'll be a nation of pedestals. There's nobody perfect that deserves a statue on the standard that all these, not just in America, this was happening in other places too. So it was happening in England, the place you were born. So it was happening. They're throwing it, you know, they're getting rid of all these famous statues because they're not the person that they would have, that they wanted them to be in 2025 and 2026. So I love that the president's doing this. I fear that a Democrat's going to come in and just wipe all this stuff out.
Yeah, it could be. It could be. It just seems like all that stuff that went on in 2020 around that time, it's over. You know, removing statues and all that kind of thing.
And
just
the green energy
faded.
Stuff. And I think energy thing on top of that. The green fever is broken. I hope.
Yeah, it's a wonderful thing, Brian. Let's be happy.
Absolutely.
Kilmeade, you're all right. Thank you very much indeed, sir. Right, we'll see you again soon.
Go get him, Stuart. I appreciate it. I mean, that's one thing that Trump is doing. I had a chance to go to the White House day after State of the Union, and you see the whole back. It's not just gold. They got the pictures. I would remove the auto pen, put Joe Biden's picture back, because it's a really good addition to be able to walk through and see all the presidents and know how many of them walk through the West Wing like that. Number two is the president wrote on the West Wing. And he's rebuilding different corridors and modernizing it. Then he put out the floor in order to get people off the grass when they have these patio meetings, congressional meetings, honorees. Now they have a place to go. It's a patio. And now he's going to put granite on the walkway instead of cement. I think it's an upgrade. My fear is, and now they're going to build the ballroom. And people say it's too big. And I worry the Democrats are going to come in there and going to go, because Trump built it, we're going to take everything down. Instead of seeing the improvements that they have. I mean, when Truman took over the White House, it was actually dangerous. Margaret's piano, his daughter, actually fell through the second floor. At one point, they go, we got to leave. And they went over to the Blair House and they gutted the whole thing. When they came back, no one said, why did he do it this way? They say, great. You know, and I believe the West Wing was built. I think it was TR because he had a small family that had nowhere for the go and play with at the same time he wanted to get work done. So I think that tells the story. And what Trump is going to tell the story, when you talk about Trump, he's going to be a developer, a real estate guy that in his first shot won the presidency, lost, and then won again. And part of the story is, look what he built here. And it's a lot of his signature. People say the ballroom's too big. I don't know. I'm not an architect. But to me, it looks pretty good, and it's going to be massive, and I think it's reminiscent of what the White House should be. You should be able to have huge events there. And if you're one of those people that has an event and you get included, I mean, I'm watching the Eagles at the Super after winning the Super Bowl. They're in the backyard on folding chairs. Thank goodness it was a nice day. If not, where are you going to put 54 men who average 280 pounds? Now, in this ballroom, when it's done in 2027-28, they'll have a place to go and be able to place to spread out their McDonald's. Goes to the Brian Kilmeade Show. So glad you did. Keep it here.
From high atop Fox News headquarters in New York City, always seeking solutions, never sowing division. It's Brian Kilmeade.
Hi, everyone. So glad you're there from 48th and 6th in Midtown Manhattan, around the country, around the world. This is the Brian Kilmeade Show. By the way, got a bunch of shows are going to be live on stage on Fox Nation. I hope you guys will check it out. I'm going to be everywhere from Jacksonville to New Jersey. New York City at Westbury Music Fair is going to be fantastic, as well as over in St. Louis. So check it out. Reno, Nevada coming up on May 30th. So go to BrianKilmeade.com. We bring history to life, the Uniting the States Tour. So before we get any further, let's go to the big three.
Number three.
It's just another one. If they would simply just work with ICE, if their law enforcement would work with ICE when they arrest illegal aliens for crimes, we could save countless lives in this country.
Yep, Tom Homan, two more illegal immigrants with criminal records kill Americans in the state of Virginia, the other one in Illinois. Ultimately, both those states are to blame, and the people that put the policies in place. Why the president has to drive that message home once and for all. It's how he got elected, and it'll get him the momentum back on immigration that means so much in this country.
Number two.
What we can do is pass the rest. We can pay the TSA workers and the rest of the Department of Homeland Security, and then do what we did this last summer, which is pass another reconciliation bill that will not only fund ICE, but do so without handcuffing them and limiting their ability to enforce our immigration laws.
Senator Cornyn on with me with a big announcement on Fox and Friends. Senate Republicans believe they found a path to end the five-week DHS shutdown after a meeting with President Trump on Monday. Two high-ranking officials said Schumer's agreed to a framework. I'll bring you the latest.
Number one.
We're giving it 5 days, and then we're going to see where that takes us. And I would say at the end of this period, I think it could very well end up being a very good deal for everybody.
We'll see. I'm not convinced. Iran and the U.S. in talks through emissaries. I don't think they're going anywhere because this death cult has nowhere to go. Use the Marines, Mr. President, to reopen the strait and finish off these thugs for the good of the world. And that's what I love to see happen. Doran Spielman joins us now, a former IDF spokesperson, and he joins us on Zoom. Welcome, Doran.
Nice to see you, Brian.
Well, first off, let me ask you how you feel about the talks going on through the Turkish foreign minister, as well as I think Pakistan's playing a role. Your thoughts about this?
Yeah, I wouldn't put a whole lot of stock in it. If we just remember, it was just last week that Pakistan said that if the United States attacks them, they will drop a nuclear weapon on India. I mean, it's the same. The leopard doesn't change its spots. I don't think that Pakistan or Turkey, both of which support terror, are really much about it. I think that President Trump is hedging his bets. If there's a miracle and Iran agrees somehow to degrade all the uranium and stop the nuclear program, he wins. If not, it buys him precious time to move American troops into the Middle East to do what he needs to do to really finish this once and for all.
How true is it, the reports that people are moving through the strait who pay Iran $2 million?
That's correct. They're being blackmailed. China is the first one to do it. He offered it to China, Pakistan, and India. And they are. It's amazing. They're being blackmailed by the largest terror state in the world. Iran thinks it's going to survive by blackmailing the world because of oil prices. I think they're underestimating most of the world. Maybe China's willing to do this. It's not a tenable solution. And it's against international law. You're not allowed to restrict a waterway from international shipping that's international territory. And it's not going to last. These are the last gasps of a dying regime, Brian. We have to understand it's just been 3.5 weeks. This regime is on its last legs. We don't. If you pick up the phone and want to call Iran, you don't even know who's going to answer at this point.
In terms of their leadership.
Absolutely. It switches. It's like a roulette wheel. Throw it, you know, you spin it. Each time it lands in a different number and then he's eliminated. There is, we know from intelligence, there's absolute discommunication that's happening between the leadership and the people in the field. And I can tell you in Israel, while we have ballistic missiles that they're firing, of course,
right now,
mainly at civilians,
yeah,
they're down from 60 a day to 8 a day. You know, they're disintegrating.
So are you convinced that they're not able to manufacture more drones and missiles right now?
Correct. Right now, if we continue what we're doing, their manufacturing facilities have been destroyed. Not only that, their launchers, you know, about 80% of the launchers are destroyed. So they're down. They have no manufacturing. They don't have raw materials. They don't have these ships coming in from China right now to bring them the raw materials. And they don't have the manufacturing facilities. So if we keep pushing, they are going to run out of ballistic missiles. And, you know, they've been firing them at everyone that they can fire them. They've been firing them at Israel. Okay, they've always said they're going to fire at Israel. They've always said they're going to shoot America. But now they fired at, you know, another 9 Arab states, all of whom were trying to court peace with them. And they're running out of ammunition. Their leadership is on the run. And I think that we're far enough along the way, we can see this through. We have to take a deep breath. People, you know, they're used to fast food, Brian. They think it's going to be fast food war. It's going to take some time. They've had 40 years to grow, but a little bit longer, a few weeks more, we're going to see cracks that are going to bring down this regime.
Do you think they've been more resilient than you thought or lasting longer than you thought? I mean, there were some reports over the weekend that the Mossad thought the regime would fall quicker.
There's been a lot of conflicting reports, and obviously there was a hope that was out there that maybe, even though it was a long shot, when you eliminate Khamenei, when you eliminate Larijani, maybe they'll just give up. But they haven't given up, and it's not a surprise. Again, these people have had 40 years not just to build a terror regime. We have to understand. They have spread the tentacles amongst thousands of people that have gotten enormously rich, that have phenomenal lifestyles, that have homes around the world while the people of Iran suffer. And they're not going to be that quick to give this up, especially if they think that the West might try to force President Trump to back down. As soon as they realize, and this is just how it goes in the Middle East, that President Trump and Israel are going to see this through, we're going to see that they are going to change sides and that they're going to realize they have no choice. They better put their chips in with the United States.
So, you know, there's two ships, USS Tripoli and the Boxer are heading our direction. So the Marines are coming. So the president says, yeah, we're going to talk. 4 more days are left in order to open up the Strait of Hormuz, or you're going to lose all your energy abilities, create energy. Lieutenant General Keith Kellogg said this about what we should do. Cut 6.
The president should press his advantage. And I really believe that we have an opportunity to really take down a regime that just survives on hate. And they hate America, they hate Israel, they hate their own people, and we should get rid of a theocratic regime that leads that government. If he does that, it's the perfect triumph for him, because now we have an organization, a government, that is going to basically get along with everybody else in the Gulf. They clearly don't do that right now.
Their greatest leverage is not their military pain, and no offense to the amount of rockets that are coming your direction and drones, but it's the economic pain. So to get that straight open would relieve a lot of pressure on Israel and the U.S. Don't you agree? And is there a military plan that you have seen that did you think would be effective to do that?
First of all, there is. If we look at the strait, we have to understand the strait is about 40 to 60 miles wide, and the shipping lanes are around 2 miles wide. Why are they so narrow? Because there's a few key small islands in that strait that the ships have to go around. Traditionally, they were held by the regime, and from there, they targeted ships. Taking over those key islands, the most important of which is Kharj to the north, would open up that canal and enable these ships to sail more towards the middle of the canal. It keeps them safe from cover from the ground. And what changes, we have to understand, Brian, you know, people keep saying oil prices are going up, and they are going up. Can we imagine what would happen if Iran had a nuclear weapon? What kind of threat they would put on the world economy? We're not talking $120 a barrel of oil. We're talking $500 a barrel of oil for much of the world. And so there are plans. They have to do with the Marines. They have to be done on the ground. And you have to take specific strategic locations, which this force, these Marine forces, are trained to do. And I think that President Trump is playing this very well. He understands the Middle East. You don't negotiate in the Middle East while your guys are leaving. You negotiate in the Middle East while your guys are coming in, and you're putting pressure on people. And I think it's a very smart move. It's a win-win in any case for him and the American people.
How real is this? MBS has called the president, and as with it, this is, just came across, and said, finish this job. Historic time to change the Middle East. Your thoughts about Saudi Arabia's stance? And I'll add this. ISW's reporting, the Institute for Study of War, that two specified sources told Israel media that Iran has decided to limit its attacks on Saudi Arabia due to concerns that the continued strikes will trigger a direct Saudi military response. Your thoughts about both those things?
First of all, I don't think that Iran is concerned about a Saudi military response. Israel and the United States have launched a military campaign, the likes of which have not been seen on Earth in many, many years from a precision perspective. I don't think that that's what's concerning them. I think that they're looking for the next day and they're saying, wait a second, we're going to lose and we alienated all of our friends. We may have somebody in the Middle East that's going to be friends. How are we going to be friends with them? We'll stop attacking them. But I think the Saudis, you know, the Saudis have always played both sides of the field, Brian. You know, they've always courted China, courted the United States. They haven't attacked Iran. And I think they're actually in a position. This is what I think is going to happen. As we continue to succeed, Saudi Arabia is going to join the fight at the end, just so they can throw a few missiles and say that they were the good guys. That is what's going to happen. Iran's not afraid of that. What Iran is afraid of is that they're going to be completely ostracized and have no one to turn to.
Doran, I know you got to be ready for all scenarios, but why do you think the Houthis have stayed out of it? And do you believe they're going to get into it once interceptor stocks are down?
You know, I don't know for sure if they're going to get involved. The reason that they have not gotten involved is they realize that their major supporter, you know, their patron, is going down the tubes. And just like with all these proxies are nothing on their own, Brian. These proxies were always, whether it's Hezbollah, Hamas, or the Houthis, they were offshoots of Iran. And if they see Iran going down, they're not going to risk their very existence to try to save a regime that's sinking. As a matter of fact, it's the most positive sign that shows that we are winning against Iran. You have a large proxy who's been an enemy who stayed completely silent. And the more we continue this campaign against Iran, we're going to see more proxies that are going to start changing their colors when they realize that the people that are feeding them are no longer going to be around.
Is the command and control on Hezbollah really the IRGC?
No question. Hezbollah, I was just speaking on Israeli TV, and I was just bringing up this point. Hezbollah was funded, trained, and told what to do by the IRGC. As a matter of fact, we've been taking out IRGC commanders on Lebanese soil even now. They're not even a proxy. It's the wrong word. They are Iran. Israel's literally fighting Iran, just clothed in Hezbollah clothing, on its northern border.
But is that different from when you've taken on Hezbollah in the past?
You know, they've always been a...
I know financed by Iran, but I was just wondering if Hezbollah was independent to a degree on military decisions, because I had heard before this conflict started, when it was just thought to be about to start, that the IRGC just moved into town and said, let me take this over. You guys are a mess.
Look, there's no question that since December of during the Biden administration in November, when President Biden, this goes back to November 2024, when President Biden told Israel to stop, when we were actually moving towards defeating Hezbollah and we stopped, the immediate reaction of Iran was to send tens of billions of dollars and one of their upper military classes to try to prop up those brigades, which really just got their butts kicked by Israel. But, you know, it was always controlled by Iran. It's controlled by Iran now. And the difference is, with this president in the White House, we're not going to go halfway now. We Israelis, we're not going to live with Iran on our northern border. This president understands that. I think the American people understand what Iran is about. We're going to push this all the way so they cannot threaten the people on Israel's northern border.
So do you believe that if the fighting ends with Iran, you guys will decide when it ends with Hezbollah?
Yes. I mean, I think so. That's exactly what's going to happen. I mean, Iran is the absolute ones that are calling the shots. And there's a direct link that as Iran moves forward, that this is what's going to happen. I mean, we can see a one-to-one parallel. You brought up the idea of the Houthis. Just like the Houthis have responded to the regime going down, there's no question, as soon as Iran is knocked out of the equation, there is no one else in the world. There's no Syria. There's no Iran that can fund Hezbollah. It is literally cutting off the umbilical cord. And now let's not forget the fact that Syria is out of the picture. Israel's controlling that eastern side. And so all the supply routes to Hezbollah have been cut off. And so this is really an opportunity, Brian, to reshape the Middle East once and for all. And Iran is the key to this.
So, Doran, I hear Hamas is reasserting themselves in Gaza because Israel can only be in so many places with so many focuses at one time.
It's true. Israel, a lot of our troops have gone north. A lot of the rest of the troops, our Air Force is obviously tied up with Iran. At the same time, we do have troops that are on what's called the yellow line, and we're holding them at bay. At this point in time, Hamas has a reprieve to some degree. They're able to, within their own territory, they're not being resupplied, but they are able to, let's say, get a rest. But they know what we know. As soon as this ends, and President Trump has been very clear about this, Israel has been clear about this, if they do not disarm and completely give up their weapons and turn themselves right in, they will be destroyed.
So I want to bring you to what are the political problems that the president's having. Democrats and Republicans always brawl, not usually on war in the beginning. But listen to Ro Khanna, who fancies himself a presidential candidate. Cut five.
This has been the biggest blunder in American foreign policy in the 21st century. And that's saying something. What have we achieved? Iran still has enriched uranium that's buried underneath. They've replaced Khamenei with Khamenei Jr. By the way, Khamenei, the older one, had a fatwa saying, I don't want to build nuclear weapons. The younger son doesn't have that fatwa.
Right.
We have gas shooting up to almost $7 where I am in California, but across the country, 30% up.
So you get the idea. We're up against the clock, but your response to that?
I've heard these voices before. They're the same voices that approached Churchill before World War II and said, let's just make peace deal with Hitler. We can't beat him. It's the same kind of delusional story. Iran has been a nuclear regime moving towards a bomb. This is the first time in history that you have an American president, you have an Israeli prime minister who are willing to stand up and fight evil. And the world will look back at this moment and say, we want to be like America and Israel. We want to stand up for Israel, too.
Doran Spielman, thanks so much. Stay safe. Former IDF spokesman coming to us from Israel. Appreciate it.
Thank you so much, Brian.
You got it. We'll take a short time out and come back at the bottom of the hour with Alberto Crane, UFC veteran, world-renowned Brazilian jiu-jitsu black belt. Don't move.
Need to know. You're with Brian Kilmeade. That makes you think. This is the Brian Kilmeade Show.
We're back. When we come back, UFC veteran, world champion of Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu, black belt, one of the pioneers of American Jiu-Jitsu, Alberto Crane, will be with us in studio, talk about what he's overcome since he was diagnosed with MS, and it's really an inspirational story. You'll hear some of that also. RAF is over the weekend. It's coming up on Saturday. We were able to highlight it on One Nation on Sunday. It's really impressive. It's the fastest growing sport in the country, real American freestyle. Freestyle as in freestyle wrestling. The reality show on Friday, and then we got the show in Tampa, in Clearwater, Tampa, Clearwater, Florida, on Saturday, 8 p.m. start. So that'll be good. So we'll make sure everyone's there for that. We're following a bunch of stories. We hope to have an announcement soon about the framework of an end to the TSA shutdown, the partial DHS shutdown, with the guy that's going to be sworn in any moment, the DHS secretary-to-be, Mark Wayne Mullen. I think it's going to be an improvement all around. I think he's already staffing up big time. He was on the phone with the president late at 1 o'clock in the morning today. They are good friends, and I think they're going to be a very functional partnership, especially because Tom Homey gets along so well. He's got all the experience. He was sidelined before, not anymore. Don't move. You listen to Brian Kilmeade Show.
Breaking news, unique opinions. Hear it all on the Brian Kilmeade Show.
So let's bring in Alberto Crane. He's an author of All In, Lessons on and Off the Mat. It comes out now. It's out now. It's out right now, right?
Not today.
Yeah, it's out in March. Long before MMA went mainstream, you were doing jiu-jitsu, right? And one of the big challenges you had in your life, you were also diagnosed with a disease, MS.
MS, multiple sclerosis.
So here you are wrestling at the top of the game, an elite athlete, and you get that diagnosis. So first off, what was the attraction to jiu-jitsu?
Some of my friends are doing it, and they invited me to do a class. That's
which city is this?
I was in New Mexico, Santa Fe, New Mexico.
Okay.
A random place, not a big city, small town, but there happened to be a jiu-jitsu guy, an early student of the Gracie Machados that was there.
Right. And you loved it from day one?
My friend tapped me out 10 times. He was much smaller than me. I couldn't believe it. I was like, let's go again, let's go again. And I couldn't stop thinking about it. I was like, I got to learn this. And I never looked back.
And how old are you now? I mean, how old were you then?
I was 18.
And how old are you now?
I am 49.
So that when did you make this your occupation?
It was gradually. One of my friends, he moved down to Brazil. One of the guys that I started jiu-jitsu with, he moved down to Brazil, moved down to Rio de Janeiro to learn from the Gracie family directly. And then he came back. We started training in his garage every day.
Right.
And then it's kind of built on it. And he told me about this book called Think and Grow Rich by Napoleon Hill. And so I wrote down my goals. And my next step was moving to Brazil. So it's just kind of gradual. And I never thought having a school or making this my living, right?
So why'd you move to Brazil? Just to be a part of it?
Well, he went down there first. He was a little bit older than me. He was like an older brother. He was about 6-7 years older than me. And so he told me, he showed me pictures, showed me all the stuff he was learning. And I was like, wow, this is amazing. I want to go there too. And so I did. I went there for 6 months. And it just gradually took me to a couple of tournaments in California and Los Angeles. And right. I just got more and more obsessed about it.
And you started competing for jiu-jitsu.
Jiu-jitsu, correct. I never thought I would fight MMA. I never thought I would be doing that.
But you knew it was a possibility, right? At this point, when you were growing up, the MMA was mainstream.
It was Valetudo days, right? You were sharing with me that you were part of the early UFCs, right?
The Ultimate Fighting.
Ultimate Fighting, right? With no gloves, no rules, right?
Yeah,
no
time limits. Knocked out, choked out. You couldn't quit.
And so I never thought I'd be doing something like that. And then one thing led to another. I got my black belt, and I was like, hey, I want to see if this stuff works in a situation, in a fight.
Right.
And King of the Cage, which is a pretty big organization at the time, came to New Mexico, where I was living, and I got on the card.
but then what did you have to learn beyond jiu-jitsu to be successful as a mixed martial artist?
The beginning, I was just a jiu-jitsu fighter, right? And back in the early days, right, you were representing your martial art to show, to prove
which your discipline was better.
Was the best, correct. So that was... It was great because I was still at those early days, a part of that, you know? And then, of course, as things evolved with time, you have to become a well-rounded, you know, fighter, right? And that means you're wrestling, your takedowns, you're striking, correct? You have to be a well-rounded, like, MMA fighter. That's it. Right. It's black and white, you know?
I remember in UFC, the guys who were really screwed were karate guys. I mean, because they didn't know how to grapple. And the guys who were doing well, that could excel as wrestlers, and the jiu-jitsu guys could do everything. Right, but still, you had to learn. As it graduated, now you got to really learn to punch more than maybe you learn in jiu-jitsu. Is that correct?
Correct. Right. It's a different.
You don't have to strike. You don't strike.
Correct. Yeah. So the beautiful thing with jiu-jitsu, and I think the monks that kind of started, the judo founder Jigoro Kano, how he made it like the right way to do it. So these guys got really good back, you know, whatever it was, 100 years ago, was he made it so you could train it realistically, right? Without any strikes, without any quick kill things, eye gouging, whatever. And his students beat all the traditional jiu-jitsu fighters or jiu-jitsu practitioners. And so that's why, you know, that kind of training went that way. And then fast forward, you know, martial arts around the world, like was very, definitely karate, taekwondo, like striking based, right? 70s, 80s, and then, you know, out of nowhere in the 90s, the Gracie family, Jorge and Gracie, started the UFC and showed the effectiveness of jiu-jitsu in a fight.
But he said not just jiu-jitsu, Gracie jiu-jitsu. What makes Gracie jiu-jitsu different?
Listen, man, like the Gracie family, without the Gracie family, there's no jiu-jitsu. There's no Brazilian jiu-jitsu. You know, the thing is he sued his family members. And, you know, his uncle, right? His uncle had 30 kids and his dad had, I don't know how many kids.
a lot,
right?
There was Helio and there was Carlos?
There was Helio. Carlos Gracie Sr. was the first person to learn, or was the older brother, actually.
Okay.
And Helio was the younger brother.
Right. And he weighed, I watched him, he was already 90 years old. He probably weighed 150. He was solid muscle, right?
I mean, still going out there, still training till the very end, till the very end.
So the Gracie Jiu-Jitsu, I know Horion came over and he was doing stunt work. He was doing movie work, telling people how to take a punch, what a real fight would look like. And then he...
Lethal Weapon, right?
Yeah. And then Mel Gibson was the one who met with John Milius to design what we now know as the Octagon. And they put it together. And the one thing they said is somebody could die tonight. And they were selling it like that. And a lot of the fighters were like, no, we don't need to sell it like that.
I mean, the first fight of the UFC, I don't know if you remember, was a sumo guy.
Sure.
And he fought a Dutch kickboxer, and he kicked his teeth out.
I remember. It went right on Jim Brown's notes. I was there. Because I was sitting by the door. He tried to get out, and Horion wouldn't let him get out of the cage. So this 600-pound guy is trying to leave. Whoever think it would ascend to this, bigger than boxing, one of the hottest sports properties in the world.
It's been an honor just to watch it, be a very, very small part of it.
But you were 15-5 as an MMA fighter?
Correct.
14 submissions.
Correct.
Right. So
I represented jiu-jitsu.
Yeah. So I'm with Alberto Crane. When did you find out that you had MS?
So every 5 years in Nevada and in California, they make you do a brain MRI to get your fight license, right, to be able to fight.
Yeah.
And so in 2007, I did my first one, and I fought in the UFC and all that. 5 years later, it was time to do a second one, and they found these lesions in my brain. So the day before the weigh-ins I was going to fight, they called me into the office, which isn't usually a good sign, right? It never happened to me before. And they said, hey, we need to do more testing. We can't give you the fight license. We need to do more testing. And they did more testing, and then they said, hey, sorry. Looks like you have multiple sclerosis.
Wow, but the lesions, were they from blows?
No, they still don't know where, your immune system, it's like an autoimmune, right, disease, and it attacks, your immune system attacks, like, the myelin sheath, like, on the electric wire, right?
Yeah, on the tendon?
If you have an electric wire, for example, right, you have the rubber around, like, the wire, right? And so the myelin is like that rubber coating, and so what happens is it basically eats that myelin sheath so that the signal doesn't get to the area. And so people lose their ability to walk, to talk, to do things, right? They get disconnected in the body.
And how many years ago was that?
2012 was my diagnosis.
But you look great. You're moving great. Do you feel any effects?
I do. I do. You know, if I'm honest, I do, and I'm scared. The same thing that I learned on the mat, with jiu-jitsu and even fighting, right, is you face it, right? You face it. And you do your best, no matter what.
And you do what's necessary to make a negative outcome least possible. And what type of things do you do?
So I found this system called TACFIT, like functional training, applied neuroscience, connecting your breath, the correct structure in your body, because the quality of your movement matters for your brain, right? And so I'm laying down myelin, right, that MS attacks while I'm doing these things. So I learned about those things, diet, right, like how you eat. There's a Dr. Walls. She has a protocol, MD, right? Mm-hmm. How to eat properly. And then just my stress management, like being around the right people. Like, I love jiu-jitsu. I love the community, And I do things that make me happy.
Right.
Like, I'm busy, right, this week with the book launch.
Your book out. Yeah.
Yeah. And I'm having fun. I'm choosing to, let's have some fun,
Mm-hmm.
And roll with it and not get stressed about things because
do you have a school?
Doesn't help. I have a school in Los Angeles, in Burbank, California, and we have a bunch of legacy affiliates. Burbank, Glendale, Pasadena, shout out Malibu, West Adams, it's like by USC. Santa Cruz is a new one, and even in Armenia, legacy San Diego as well. I've been doing it for a little bit,
And what makes your school different?
I think the culture is very, very strong. I hear that over and over and over. The quality of people and just the culture, it's just a great environment.
And it's all ages, right?
All ages. Our oldest student is 80 years old, one of our black belts, and he trains. He's in there He's in there almost every day.
You know, it's just interesting in reading Hickson's book. It seemed like back in those days, he's older than you, but there were always challenges. Do you have those challenges too, where they'll come up and say, I want my best guy to fight your best guy?
That was the early days when I first started my school. People don't realize that. You know, there was a, he produced a couple, not movies, but kind of products.
Documentaries?
Like, documentaries of Gracie in Action was one. And the other one was Hickson Gracie's, what was it called? Choke. And so I would educate people on how jiu-jitsu works by those videos.
Right. So you didn't feel competition.
No. Yeah. People would come in off of the street. It was on my, they would come off the street and they would challenge you. They want to see if this stuff worked. But the regular students or people that came in after the first day to try it out, I would show them those videos to show them how it worked, you know, in a real situation.
In a day in which, you know, you have to worry about to kind of handle yourself. Do you find that, you know, okay, you want to be this accomplished fighter. That's why you did it. Now you want to be an entrepreneur. That's why you start the class. Don't you feel to a degree almost everybody should be doing this to be able to protect themselves on the street, to have some fundamentals down?
You know, like the fighting, the self-defense aspect, I really feel in my heart, it's like kind of at the bottom of the list of the benefits. It brings you to your present moment. It really brings out the best in you. Yes, you learn how to
fight.
Someone
put your hands on you. You should.
Yeah. And it works. It works. You know, like, I think it should be mandatory for police officers, people in that kind of a, you know, job, right? To have like skills. And it's not just doing a seminar or doing a workshop here and there. It's like a lifestyle, right? That jiu-jitsu, I think it's a lifestyle. And, you know, and just being calm under stress, being calm in difficult situations where you can make the right decisions.
Understood. And I think that the FBI just hired a handful of UFC guys to train them.
Amen.
But like I've always found out after studying these guys is that, Alberto, you have to do it consistently. Taking two or three classes is not going to do anything unless it's instinct, correct?
That's it.
And how long does it take to make it second nature instinct?
You know, shout out to our chief of police of Burbank, and he's been coming in, and he's very, very busy, right? And he makes time to come in, and I think the consistency is the key, you know. And I think within like 3-4 months of being consistent,
3-4 months, two or three times a week.
Yeah, 2 times a week is great, you know. 2 times a week is perfect. 1 time a week, it's better than nothing, but 2 times a week is perfect. And 3-4 months of consistent, the right kind of training, I think you can start to get a sense, not panic, right? Stay calm under stress, the stressful situations, and just kind of get a sense, you know? And then, of course, you keep going, though.
Right.
That's how we get you, and then you keep going after.
And then you want it because you want to be around the people, and you said it's the culture of jiu-jitsu.
That's it.
Because my partner, my co-anchor, Lawrence Jones, does jiu-jitsu.
Amazing.
Had a major eye injury, and he's like, I'm going back to jiu-jitsu anyway. Because he wants to be a part of it.
That's it. That's it.
And overall, with your book, it's not just about jiu-jitsu. It's like how it affected your life and then what you're doing now with this challenge.
Yeah, I think it's the gifts that jiu-jitsu gave me were the character development things, right? It made me a better person, right? Just I lost a lot when I first started competing, just having to deal with that. And it made me very, like, strong, right? Like, mentally. Besides, of course, the physicality of it, but just my mindset to deal with difficult situations. And MS was probably the biggest fight of my life, and and how I'm dealing with it is a testament to the jiu-jitsu lifestyle, to all the things that I've done in the past. And so it's that story, right?
Wow. So just if you sell it to the people that do jiu-jitsu, your book is going to be a bestseller. Alberto Crane.
I heard it's already number one bestseller on Amazon.
That's fantastic.
Yeah.
So pick it up. Alberto Crane, All In, Lessons on and Off the Mat. It is out this week, is it?
Today.
Today is the first day. So it's out today. So keep it number one, and then you get on the New York Times bestseller list and continue to sell. And will you be at the Octagon match at the White House?
Oh, man, I would love to be.
What does that mean to the sport?
Oh, my God. I would have never thought that we were going to see a UFC at the White House. Come on.
Right.
Come on. they were blocking it. Come on. Like, you remember those early days? Like,
yeah.
They were blocking it. McCain, right?
I was told when I did this and I put together, for me, I have to put together tapes. So they don't really want to see your resume. They want to see what you look on camera. I was told, whatever you do, don't put UFC on your tape. because they would call it human cockfighting. They banned it in 48 states.
John McCain,
it was in Denver. Yeah, John McCain was killing it. It was a big move, and they got it to New York City at Madison Square Garden because New York said no way.
Right. It took them forever to do that.
And now it's at the White House.
Amazing.
I believe the locker room will be the Oval Office, and they're going to march out from there.
I mean, it's like.
You gotta get yourself a ticket.
I think I have to go. Yeah, you're right. You know, I think it's free. I don't know. I think he's not charging, right?
No, I think you need an invite though.
You need an invite for sure. Yeah.
You gotta do that. pick up your book, All In, Lessons on and Off the Mat. Alberto, great to see you. Great to meet you. Congratulations on everything.
Thank you so much.
Back in a moment.
From breaking news to big name guests, Brian brings you insight you won't hear anywhere else. You're listening to The Brian Kilmeade Show. Sponsored by Prevagen. Prevagen, made for your brain.
What changes would you like to see in DHS under Mark Wayne Mullen?
Well, he's going to be fantastic. He'll make his own change. He's already given me a list of people he wants to bring. He's a fantastic guy. I think he's just the right guy. You all know him. He's a very open, smart guy, very successful, actually, in business, which people don't know. And he's a friend of mine. I think Mark Wayne is going to be fantastic.
So that's President of the United States, and he's being sworn in now. Senator Mark Wayne Mullen is going to be Secretary Mark Wayne Mullen. He's going to be Secretary Mullen, who's taken over for Kristi Noem at DHS. And the good news is, confirmed by two higher-ups, one sitting senator, after meeting with the President of the United States and talking up until 1 in the morning, they've come up with a framework agreed to by Chuck Schumer. If he can get his caucus in line, and we believe he can. Remember, you only need 6 votes. That they would fund everything at Homeland Security except ICE. That means all but 6% of the entire budget. What is ICE going to do? They have money from the Big Beautiful Bill, and there's going to be a second reconciliation bill that's going to pass a little bit later that'll have full ICE funding and funding for what's needed for the Save America Act. And it's going to put in play everything on the Save America Act in the states that subscribe. And in September, go back with another reconciliation. And follow me here. When you do reconciliation, it's finance oriented, which means you only need 50 votes. They have it with the vice president's vote, and they're going to fold in the Save America Act on that. So why is this important? Everyone's going to get paid. They're supposed to have a framework all done and get everybody paid Thursday. Could happen earlier, but Chuck Schumer, and they framed out a deal. This is done. So this is important that everyone understands, because you're waiting online sometimes 4.5 hours to get on a plane and you still miss the plane. This is maddening, but there's light at the end of the tunnel. Everybody realizes it. I can't see a scenario, judging by the people I've spoken to, both high-ranking sources, that the three now, because Senator Cornyn went on the record, three that say this is going to get done unless Chuck Schumer gets such blowback and he's so concerned about his job. But look, does this make you look tough? I think it makes you look dumb. So don't forget, go to BrianKilmeade.com. Streaming on Fox Nation, we're going to have History, Liberty, and Laughs, and also morphing into Uniting the States. It's us on stage talking about a patriotic, motivational, inspirational night. And also, you can get tickets at BrianKilmeade.com. The first date is Reno, Nevada on the 30th, on the 11th in Pensacola, Florida, and a whole bunch of dates coming up in October and November. Brian Kilmeade Show.